This recording is a service of the Allen County Public Library's audio reading service. It is specifically designed for and directed to people who have visual, physical, learning, or language challenges to reading traditional printed materials.
Welcome to Black News and Culture. Featuring articles from leading magazines and websites, Black News and Culture offers you a comprehensive look at Black issues, style, music, entertainment, and more. Available only on the audio reading service. It's Black News and Culture, coming up next.
Welcome. This is Black News and Culture, and I'm your reader, Salathiel Regan, with the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Today, I'll begin reading from Essence Magazine, the March-April 2024 issue, the beauty issue. 4C Files. Beauty expert Dana Oliver reflects on the grief and growth of going gray while embracing life's changes. March-April 2024. Life started moving incredibly fast when I entered my 30s. I gave birth to my son just a few weeks after turning 33. I was grappling with the end of a long-term relationship and transitioning into what I hoped would be a smooth co-parenting arrangement. I wasn't being challenged at work and sought every opportunity to flex my creativity. It seemed as though the stress of life had manifested in rapidly growing silver strands. I returned to my stylist's chair with postpartum thinning edges and lackluster locks. I was in need of a serious transformation. She got my curls together and encouraged me to embrace the grays, but that was easier said than done. I was the only one in my immediate family who had gone gray at an early age. My grandmother, mother, and aunts had concealed their graying hair until they were older. Subconsciously, I started to believe that this physical characteristic represented the end of my young, vibrant life as I knew it. Would I be perceived as older and dull? Had my black cracked? The thought of covering my grays popped into my head occasionally. However, this new normal of being a career woman and mother didn't afford me the opportunity to book and keep hair color appointments. My morning and evening routines were 10 minutes at the most, which included refreshing my strands with a moisture mist and reciting beauty affirmations with my son. If I wasn't confident with my gray coils, how could my child learn to love and accept his curls? I eventually decided to get a tapered cut, which would force me not to hide behind a halo of hair. I vividly remember the moment I picked up my son after getting this short do. His eyes widened with awe at our matching mommy and me afros. My son gave me the courage to trust this journey of falling in love with my natural graying hair again. Going gray has been unpredictable, yet far from boring. A bit like motherhood. No 2 days are the same. However, one thing I've been consistent with is maintaining a holistic hair care routine. This includes drinking 64 ounces of water daily, taking supplements like Nutrafol, and moving to a plant-based diet for shinier, fuller, and healthier hair. Speaking kindly to and about my grays also helps boost my mood. And when it comes to products, of course, I have to keep it clean. Once I've gently detangled my hair, I typically reach for Olaplex Hair Perfector No. 3 as a pre-wash. I let it sit on my tresses for up to 15 minutes to repair breakage. I then use InnerSense Organic Beauty Hydrating Cream Hair Bath and Conditioner because it cleanses my hair without stripping it of natural oils. Plus, it smells divine. Whenever I am dealing with a dry, flaky, and itchy scalp, I'll start with a targeted treatment like DHS Zinc Shampoo or TPH by Taraji Master Cleanse and follow up with hydrating conditioners. Hairstylist Dominique Burton Atkinson, the only woman I trust to do my silk presses, introduced me to 1212, a plant-based hair care line with a detoxifying mud mask that's been a game changer for removing buildup. The styling heroes in my regimen include InnerSense Organic Beauty I Create Hold, layered with Uncle Funky's Daughter Curly Magic Curl Stimulator. Curl expert Tori McCutcheon taught me how to perfect my wash and go with those two products. In recent months, I've decided to forego traditional leave-in conditioners. They often leave my curls limp, especially the grays. Then there are days when I want larger-than-life hair. To achieve this look, I'll do a low-heat blow-dry using Briogeo Farewell Frizz Blow-Dry Perfection and Heat Protectant Crim, and the Dyson Supersonic. Next, I'll section my hair to create two strand twists by applying just a dab of Shea Moisture Coconut and Hibiscus Curl Enhancing Smoothie before rolling with old-school sponge rollers. I find it's best to let this set overnight while wearing a silk scarf, and then unravel, fluff, and finish with textured pressed black magic oil for added shine. Simply letting my gray hairs be has been my best hair decision yet. I understand that it isn't easy for many black women. My hope is to rewrite the narrative of going gray to include experiences that hold space for both grief and growth. Dana Oliver. Black love is bankable. Luxury event planners talk industry shifts, trends for 2024, and the most lavish black celebrity weddings they've orchestrated by Kimberly Wilson. While the act of marriage is a celebration of love and commitment, here in the United States, weddings are also big business. And best believe, the multi-billion dollar industry is cashing in on black love. Although 2020 may have seen a decline for the industry, with postponements and cancellations related to COVID-19 quarantines, weddings are now returning to pre-pandemic levels. The year 2023 saw 2.24 million weddings in the U.S., up 62% since 2020, according to Zippia, an online job search website. The post-pandemic surge of nuptials is projected to grow to a staggering $413.98 billion industry by 2030, more than double the $160.5 billion spent on weddings in 2020. Not surprisingly, it's all shifting with the times. That means the next few years will not only see an uptick in the number of couples saying their I do's, but also wedding planners, DJs, caterers, photographers, and per-guest costs will all become more expensive. How does an industry centered on love keep that sentiment as the foundation when so many millions of dollars are being spent on these elaborate celebrations globally each year? Well, it's a challenge for sure. Inflation and high demand for wedding services mean the real driver of love, from the perspective of weddings, is money. The increase in weddings will likely cause the overall prices to rise. Products and services may be in shorter supply. Businesses may become short-staffed, and the soaring costs of travel, as well as the general unpredictability of airlines, may threaten to disrupt everyone's plans. Inflation has certainly made us alter our vision a bit for our wedding in order to not exceed our budget, says Jillian Carter, a Washington, D.C.-based May 2024 bride who will be getting married at Casa de Campo Resort and Villas in La Romana, Dominican Republic. Lucky for us, our wedding planners have been able to negotiate better rates on our behalf. Wedding planners are just a percentage of an engaged couple's overall budget. But in the era of social media and doing it for the gram, planners are tasked with coming up with concepts that are becoming more and more over the top. Tori Williams, for example, is a world-renowned celebrity event planner, a designer, and a co-star of VH1's original series, My Celebrity Dream Wedding. In her line of work, she has produced events for T.I., K. Michelle, Will Packer, former Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms, and more. She has seen it all and done it all. On a day-to-day basis, she is managing bigger budgets, longer guest lists, and grander ideas. The highest budget wedding I've done was near seven figures, says Williams. Though she's unable to share the who, the what consisted of custom Swarovski crystal chandeliers enclosed by lush white orchids, more than 100,000 fresh florals throughout the ceremony and reception, and an A-list Grammy-winning performer. Hiring a wedding planner is the best investment you can make, she insists. It's like hiring a great attorney to represent you. The planner is there to negotiate for you and make decisions that are in the best interest of the couple. They can make the planning process a stress-free, enjoyable, and memorable experience for the couple. Despite the inevitable bumps that will come as we see the economy continue to shift, couples will continue to plan original weddings that are infused with joyful energy. Luxury wedding planner, floral designer, and entrepreneur Akeshi Akinsai of Kesh Events identifies three trends that will rule the 2024 destination wedding sphere: personalized and meaningful endeavors, culturally immersive entertainment, and multi-day celebrations. These extended celebrations allow couples to spend more quality time with their guests and offer a more in-depth and regal experience. With a knack for bringing elegance, creativity, and personalization to every event, Akinsai is up for the challenge. Couples are moving away from the traditional and embracing ceremonies and receptions that are a true reflection of their unique love stories and preferences, she says. This shift is particularly evident in the realm of entertainment. It's an era that transcends the conventional DJ-only setup. We are witnessing an upsurge in a range of the finest entertainment options, including ceremony choirs, innovative band and DJ fusions, captivating dancers, and enchanting singers. But this isn't just about music. It's about crafting an experience that will linger in the memories of the guests long after the event. For NBA star Tobias Harris and his bride, Jasmine Winton, Akinsai added a personal touch to a grand event that began even before guests walked through the door. The Save the Date was a customized wine box complete with an individualized bottle with the same level of specific attention carried through the wedding itself. Our goal was to craft a unique experience for every part of the wedding celebration, focusing on distinctive entertainment, decor, lighting, and more, says the Chicago-based planner. The spectacular fireworks display was particularly memorable, adding to the grandeur of the event. Each element, each moment of the wedding was intricately woven to not just tell their story, but to celebrate it in a way that was as unique as their bond. This wedding, in all its glory, was not just a milestone for the couple, but also a landmark in my career. It symbolized the essence of trust and collaboration and the pursuit of excellence and celebration. While the wedding industry may be shifting, one thing remains. Black love is continuing to thrive, and as long as it does, the industry will continue to bank on it. And now, from Ebony. Epic Black Image. Pulitzer Prize-winning Louisville photographer John Cherry captures the soul of storytelling through his lens. By Mina Anderson, published March 27, 2024. Cherry spoke with Ebony about what inspires him, how he stays calm during a protest, and what stories he tells with his images. In the world of photography, Pulitzer Prize winner John Cherry stands as a beacon of storytelling throughout the art of observation. In an interview with Ebony, Cherry delves into his photographic philosophy, revealing how his heart guides his lens. From capturing the essence of violent protest to navigating the complexities of modern storytelling, Cherry shares insights into his journey as a photographer. Ebony, what makes you stop and think, this is something I need a photograph of? John Cherry, I think the things that make me stop and want to take a photo is an appreciation of a scene. Ultimately, it comes down to, for me at least, why you stop and take a photograph is how you see it with your heart instead of with your mind. So sometimes you can go outside of what would be a traditionally good photograph and go for something that's weird and off the wall, but it's still very much you. I tried to incorporate the art of observation and sharpen my observation skills into my practice. Do you have a particular type of genre or genre of photography that's your favorite to look at? I like photographers of all types. I love looking at pictures in general, so I'm totally down anytime somebody wants to show me a picture. I love the craft so much, and I love contributing, or at least talking about the health of storytelling as a concept, like as a human concept. I find it to be very constructive to open your heart and be accepting of people who are interested in photography, because you never know where they could be with it. How did you discover photography was a passion for you? I found it early on, when I was probably 8. My father was a photographer when he was younger, like a hobbyist, and he was practicing photography at the advent of the first digital point-and-shoot cameras. He was a watchmaker, and he would sell his watches on eBay. And this was back in the dial-up internet days, back when eBay was first coming out. He would take pictures and set up these little studios in his watch workshop. So he set the little camera up on a small tripod and take pictures of these watches with all the lights. Then when he was upgrading cameras, he let me borrow that one, and I would sit. I was really big into action figures when I was younger. I would make these stop-motion sequences of these G.I. Joes. Sometimes it would be two of them fighting each other, or they'd be climbing up something. I would scroll through the camera reel, and I would show it to my parents. And I remember my mom being so impressed with this because I would spend hours and hours in my room with the door closed making these things. I think she was impressed at the dedication. That was really encouraging for me. Do you ever get anxious going into an unfamiliar environment to take photographs? I think that's a really common anxiety for a lot of photographers, is that whenever you pull out the camera and you smash it up against your face, you are doing a completely different thing than everyone else who's around. Like, you're just there capturing stuff. Some people don't want to be captured. People are wondering why you're there. Who is this guy? Right? But then, I think that at the same time, the role of storytellers in our larger scope of humanity is not a new thing. It's probably one of the things that humans were built for. For thousands and thousands and thousands of years, there have always been people who were elected to be the word-of-mouth connoisseurs who sit around the fire and give ceremonies and tell everybody about how the way things used to be, and it helps explain the world around them. I think that still exists, but it has changed forms in the Western world. I think we have found some alternate ways to convey these past messages and try to explain the world around us. How do you think you fit into the network of global storytellers? I feel like I was elected to do this. I think a lot of evidence comes from my work doing the Breonna Taylor protest. That was my first entry into photojournalism, and I didn't even know what photojournalism was. To me, photojournalism was like being an astronaut. How do you even do that? I have no idea. Whenever the protests started in Louisville, very quickly people responded and engaged with my work in a way that supported me directly. People were donating me money, leaving food on my porch, donating body armor, making sure that I had what I needed to go out and tell these stories. So I became this crowd-funded citizen photojournalist for a couple of months. I can't thank the community in Louisville enough for elevating my work, encouraging me, and inspiring me. A lot of Epic Black Images image series focuses exclusively on art. Your photography is undeniably art, of course, but there is also a theme of mainstream U.S. politics, from capturing images of Breonna Taylor protests to life during the COVID-19 pandemic. When you're at the scene of a protest or the aftermath of a disaster, how do you balance getting an artistic photograph and maintaining the authenticity of what's happening outside the camera's lens? There's a lot of talk within this industry, like documentary work about what truth is, right? Is there such a thing as objectivity, or is there such a thing as truth? I personally don't think that objectivity is real. I think it's a healthy goal to strive for. I think that we are all laden with biases, and I think that if you interrogate those, you're doing the good work. I try to interrogate those biases, and sometimes I want to prove myself wrong. The Breonna Taylor protests were an example of me wanting to express my own curiosity. At the same time, at the beginning of 2020, it was a pretty hectic year. It was a bad time for black folks. On May 25th, we watched George Floyd be murdered on television over and over and over and over again. And I was heartbroken, angry, and felt like I didn't have anywhere to turn. We hear about these kinds of extrajudicial police killings happening all the time. Breonna Taylor was the real kicker because they busted down her door and shot the place up like while she was chilling in the house in the middle of the night. So I was just as inspired to take to the streets as everyone else was. I wanted to contribute in some way, and I wanted to show how other people felt about what I was feeling. You won a Pulitzer for your photographs of the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol. What was it like being in that tumultuous and eventually violent crowd? I've always been interested in extremism. I never really had a vehicle to bring me into those circles or those spaces. And so I was introduced to some extremist groups during the Breonna Taylor protests in Louisville. I'd never seen that before. Through my connection and understanding with those folks at the height of the Trump campaign, and then whenever Trump lost the election in 2020, some of the online channels that I was a part of began talking about what they were going to do to retaliate. Everyone that was there on January 6th was dressed for violence. There was a general air of aggression. Walking through the crowds, there were people I saw who were aggressive with me. They were either trying to grab hold of my stuff, spitting on me, or pushing me whenever the riot actually started. And it was, as we know, it was an incredibly violent day. There were a lot of members of the journalism community that were assaulted that day. I was very lucky that the physical transgressions that I underwent were relatively minor. It was a cacophony of screaming and shouting, flashbangs going off, various types of crowd dispersal, wasp spray, bear mace, and tear gas that was just being used pretty much nonstop throughout the entire riot. You asked earlier if I was afraid, and I find that very often, whenever I'm photographing, I move into a higher plane of my own psyche, where those kinds of emotions like fear and anger and sadness don't really exist. I don't want to say numb, but I feel like those emotions are happening within someone that's separate from me. And so it's really after any of these things happen is my opportunity to process it all. Part of it is because if I had been able to express how I truly felt during it, I would have been curled up in a ball crying, right? What other artists, contemporary or not, inspire your photography? I was always a big movie person. Spike Lee has always been a really big inspiration for me. As far as photographers go, pretty easy to always say Gordon Parks. He was like the first photographer that I'd ever really heard of. Whenever I look at his career and life and see all the different things that he did, you know, from being a fashionista to being a director to being one of the greatest documentary photographers ever lived, and how his career took so many different forms, his ways of being like just an eclectic, empathetic, and busy dude. I feel like I really connect with that. I think the ultimate inspiration, though, that I always feel is that of my colleagues. We have an amazing ability these days to be able to just open up Instagram and have access to some of the best work ever produced. And I could look at, you know, multiple award winners. Not that awards mean anything, really, but like, look at incredibly inspiring work. How does your identity as a black man, mixed man, influence what images you want to capture? For every photographer, who they are informs the direction that they point their camera in, right? And it affects the topic that they're interested in. For me, I am really interested in the ripple effects of colonialism. How is it present today, although it has changed form? I am interested in holding the powers that be accountable. There are a lot of people that look like me that are willing to go and do that kind of work. And I've had a lot of people within my own black community that have been upset with me for platforming the politicians or the extremists or the opinions that go against what they want to see. But I think that we can't shield ourselves from things that we don't want to see. The subjects that I'm interested in are the things that I'm curious about, and I'd like to take the audience on my journey with me to see these things and see them in the way that I see them. Do you have anything else you want to speak on? Tell the people what you have going on. I have an exhibition. I always sell the pieces off, and I always have a nonprofit of some sort that I fold into it so that they can be the benefactor of a portion of the sales. I'm selling off all of those pieces and splitting the profits with Appalachians for Appalachia, because I do believe in finding ways to support those who do the work through the ways in which we photograph. So trying to sell off all those pieces, we've got 15 of them and sold 2 so far. Well, that's all the time we have for today. This has been Salathiel Regan with Black News and Culture. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading from the audio reading service at the Allen County Public Library in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Take care.